cancer diagnosis at the age of 32, my mom and I talked a lot about the shock of that diagnosis, given several doctors told us you're too young to have endometrial cancer. After much discussion, we began to feel driven to inform and help educate other young women about what symptoms they should be concerned.
Having both been teachers, it seemed natural for us to look for a way to share Alex's cancer journey in order to help other young women avoid such a shocking diagnosis or possibly navigate a similar path. A podcast seemed the best way to get the word out, and that's how Down There Aware was born.
4 years later, our mother-daughter duo has gone from educating and informing to advocacy and action, with a fresh and sometimes very interesting and somewhat humorous multi-generational perspective.
We look forward to sharing with you season 4 as we advocate, take action, and make it a priority to always be
Down There Aware.
Welcome back to another episode of Down There Aware. How's it going?
Well, we haven't done water aerobics in a while because we've been rained out or we've been out of town or something, and I'm hating that because
I know it's very frustrating. And the way the schedule works out, the only classes I can go to are because of work are Monday, Wednesday, Friday. Those are their evening classes. So, you know.
We'll get back at it because it really was fun.
Yeah, I have been playing pickleball.
Oh, I know.
Much to my mother's dismay.
Because you are a rag when you leave.
Well, so we go early in the morning, like 8 o'clock in the morning, and we play for, first time we did it was like an hour, and the next time was like 2 hours. And then I come home and I shower because it's really gross, and then I take a nap.
It's bad.
But what? That's a great Sunday.
Well, I'm just praying you don't have a cardiac event.
If I do, I got a thingy.
Yes, you do.
It'll shock me right back. I'm pointing to my chest if you aren't watching the YouTube. This is your reminder that you need to subscribe to us and watch us on YouTube. You really get a better picture, I think, than just listening to the podcast. Yeah. Wouldn't you say?
Yeah, I'm glad we finally did that, although we really haven't been able to record with no makeup and no hair and our pajamas and all that. I guess we could, but I don't want to do that to people.
Yeah, it's a little, it's just a little bit different. But yeah, so today's episode, I'm not even sure where it kind of came from, but we started talking about the term gaslighting and medical gaslighting in particular. Hey, Mike, what you doing? And then I asked Mom, I said, do you know where that term comes from? And I was really excited because I had like recently learned this and she didn't know. And it's actually from a play, a British play from the late 30s. And then it was made into a movie, a British movie in 1940, and then an American movie in 1944. So Mom and I just finished watching the American version just to kind of see, like, we knew obviously what the term meant and that it came from this movie, but like how it came to be.
Yeah.
And it was fascinating.
It is fascinating that a movie from 1944, mm-hmm. just the title of the movie has kind of stood the test of time.
Yeah.
And is still used to describe gaslighting nowadays.
Yeah.
And we don't even use, well, I guess we do use gaslight.
But like not in your home.
It's kind of a big thing on the makeover shows to do the outside porch lights.
All right, well, I don't watch makeover shows, but it's interesting, just the whole premise of this woman, her husband convinces her she's crazy. I mean, that's kind of the short of it.
Yeah, slowly.
He has ulterior motives, and there's a reason for it and all that, and that's, we won't spoil that part of it, but slowly makes her think she's going crazy. And where the gaslight comes in is the home has gas-powered lights and
inside,
and she notices that the light goes down at certain times when her husband's gone from the house. And the only way that can happen is if somebody else is in the house and turns another light on, because it takes the gas from that. And nobody's in the house. allegedly. And so, you know, she's being driven mad of saying, well, the light's going down. He's like, no, it's not. No, it's not. And so it kind of made us think of, that's happened a few times, in particular with us, with medical things.
Yes. I immediately thought of when I was expecting Alex, and I have to go back to 3.5 years before that when I was expecting Will. And let me see how I can make this as short as
really
possible.
Really short.
Will ended up weighing 11 pounds, 3 ounces, and was 23.5 inches long. He was much bigger than the doctor thought. And I had regular ultrasounds and all, as many as they do.
But it was 1983.
Yeah, they don't really do a lot of them back. They didn't do a lot of them back then. And so he was huge. And I had him vaginally. And in labor, his head came out, and they could not get the rest of him out. And it became a real serious emergent situation. And they tried all these different techniques, one of which is the nurse lying on top of me. And, you know, it was a big male nurse, and he put his forearms on my stomach and went 1, 2, 3, and then put all his weight on me. And he did that several times. They tried several things. Anyway, they finally got Will out, and he had what's called shoulder dystocia. And I'd never heard of that. But the pediatrician who examined him after delivery came in all sober, somber, and, you know, said to me he had shoulder dystocia, he couldn't move his arms, and he said this could be temporary or it could be permanent damage. And we didn't know for probably a couple hours. But slowly the nerves did what they do and the numbness went away and he ended up being fine. In the meantime, my OB-GYN told me that this was the worst case of shoulder dystocia he has ever seen that had this good of an outcome. Which that, you know, I was very...
That says a lot.
It says a lot. He was probably in his 50s, so he wasn't like a newbie. He'd only delivered 10 babies. I mean, he was, you know, a veteran OB-GYN. So that, when I got pregnant with Alex, got me to thinking about birth, her birth. And I had gestational diabetes testing, and I didn't have it. You know, there were all the tests.
There were no indications that Will was going to be big. And then when I came along, there were no indications that I would be big.
Right.
But as a precaution.
And so I was concerned, and we had moved away from Gainesville, so I couldn't have my same doctor. That would have been ideal.
Yeah.
But I couldn't. So when I went to my OB-GYN in Fort Walton Beach area, and they heard about Will and read my file and everything, he said he thought I should go to a high-risk pregnancy doctor. And the closest one was in Pensacola. So that's what I did. And talked to this doctor, and he kept telling me that what happened to me was rare, that there was no reason to believe it would happen again, that there was, because I said I want a C-section. I said I don't want to risk that I'll have another child with shoulder dystocia but won't have a good outcome. And he argued with me. I can't even tell you. It was every visit we had this argument. And I told him, I said, I will go somewhere else, but I do not want to have this child vaginally. And so anyway, he said, okay, I'm lying on the table ready to have my C-section. And he, as I perceived it, very arrogantly looked up and looked at his staff around the table and said, this is an elective C-section. So that's my experience with gaslighting.
Well, and
he made me feel like I was crazy.
Yeah, he made you feel like you were not sane for wanting to protect your child, that he knew more than you, that, you know, you didn't know what you were talking about.
It had nothing to do with pain. I'd already had the pain with the vaginal birth.
Right, like whatever.
And I don't care what anybody says, a C-section pain is a different kind of pain, but it's just as much pain.
Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't about that. It really, honestly, was not about me at all. I just thought, why would you risk, if that happened to you and you were fortunate enough that it wasn't a horrific outcome, why in the world would you tempt fate and risk it again if there was a way not to?
Right, exactly. So, you know, I think that's a... I wish I had like a sound effect like, bring gaslight.
And as it turned out, Alex weighed 8'12" and was like 20 and a half inches long, but they took her 2 weeks early. So I don't know that she would have gotten up to 11'3" like Will, but she definitely, you know, they gained a lot of weight the last 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
And so 8'12" was a big enough baby.
Yeah.
She would have been even bigger. So I don't regret it at all. And I wasn't going to see him again. I wasn't going to have any more babies.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't care what he thought about me.
Well, and even if you were, you still shouldn't care,
that's
right?
That's true. That's
because
true.
You have to advocate for yourself. And
haven't we talked about that?
Yeah.
A lot?
I mean, Mary Massey advocating for herself since 1986.
That might have been one of the first times, really.
Yeah. Because you had to.
I had to.
You absolutely had to. So, you know, when we were kind of talking about different gaslighting examples for me, I mean, obviously there's the whole you're too young to have this kind of cancer, but I don't think he tried to make me feel bad about that.
No, I don't
either. I don't consider that gaslighting, but I did have, so in 2015, I started having all of the same symptoms I had had 13 years before that in high school when I was diagnosed with idiopathic intracranial hypertension and got a shunt put in.
I thought it was 2013, right after the wedding.
No, you're wrong.
But we had just come back from Cocoa Beach.
We were in Cocoa Beach for Labor Day.
Okay, it was
we
Labor Day.
We had like brunch at the golf course.
Yes, it was Labor Day, yes.
It was Labor Day weekend. And
sorry.
It's okay. I had to, like, I was so dizzy and my head was pounding. I had that whooshing sound in my ears.
You laid down in the back seat.
Well, that's what I was going to say. It was September.
Yeah.
In Central South Florida. Hot, hot, hot. And I elected to leave a very tasty brunch and go lie in the back seat of the car, not running, because I was so miserable.
Yeah.
And so at that point, we were like, okay, what's going on? So I went to the urgent care because
it was the weekend.
And it was closed and everything, and was seen, and they were like, it's an ocular migraine. And I said, listen, I have a shunt for this reason, and these are the symptoms.
Same symptoms.
All the same symptoms that I had before I had the shunt. I think the shunt's not working. Like, I think that's probably it. Can I talk to a neurologist? Can I talk to a neurosurgeon? This is an ocular migraine. And they put me on medication.
And they could have solved the whole thing had they done
a spinal tap.
That's
all they had to do.
But when we suggested that, they said you didn't need it.
Yeah. And it's this constant thing of, I'm the doctor.
Mm-hmm.
I know it's right. And not every doctor is like this. And we don't believe every doctor's like
no.
this. These are very specific examples. However, in that moment, now, and on top of it, and I really feel, I don't remember her name in the movie, Paula. I feel Paula's pain because she just was like overcome with, well, I guess I'm wrong, and I guess this is whatever.
I guess what he's saying
is true. I guess what he's saying is true. On top of physical pain and discomfort and... And it's really hard to explain unless you have IIH or something similar. But the pain, I call it pain because that's really the only thing I can say of what it is. But it really is this pressure feeling. And there's no relief from it.
Mm.
You can't walk. You can't sit up. You can't, I mean, even lying flat, it sometimes is not helpful. So it's just, you just feel so dejected of, well, I guess this is how I'm going to live the rest of my life because you're not listening to me. And so it took probably another week or two of dealing with all of the pain and going and going to this doctor and having this medication, and finally somebody said, let's check out your shunt. I was like, thank you.
Hello.
That's exactly what I've been asking for. And when I met with the neurosurgeon, and that was when Mom got in touch with Dr. Mary Jennifer Markham, who got us in touch with a great neurosurgeon in town, and we kind of got in, and he was like, why are you here? Like, he was like, yeah, I know. Yeah, Mary Jennifer, yeah, I know. And we're like, no, really. And we told him all my symptoms, told him everything, and he was like, let's do a spinal tap. Took me down the hall in the office, and he did it himself, which is kind of unheard of. You know,
which what that shows is the CSF, the cerebral spinal fluid pressure.
Yeah.
And so when they do it, they can tell instantaneously if you have too much CSF around your brain, and if you do, it can be hydrocephalus, or it can...
Right, it can be all kinds of things, but I had been diagnosed.
I had already had surgery.
Done.
And have a shot for it.
Right, exactly. And so he did it in the office. And I mean, he even said, like, are you okay? Because the whole thing with a spinal tap is you have to, like, lie flat for 24 hours after that. And so Satan's making some music with the tail. So you have to lie flat. And he was like, are you okay? I was like, yes, please do this. And sure enough, it showed exactly what we thought it did, or what it would. And it was right. And all it took was somebody to listen to me for what I knew was happening.
Yeah. But like you said, they kept telling you it was an ocular migraine. And we have seen this in the medical community. Somebody will get something in their mind.
Yeah.
That this is, and maybe it's because they've seen so many people who had that and had these symptoms or whatever.
Right. Well, and I also think, you know, they teach first year residents, when you hear hoofbeats, it's not always a zebra.
Yeah.
You know, to look into the common things, the horses, right? Like, make sure that you're covering all your bases. And I get that, particularly because testing is expensive.
Yeah.
It is rare that it's going to be a zebra. Like, yeah, you're most likely going to have a horse. However, when your patient has a file like mine and has people in their corner and themselves who are advocating and who are aware and well-educated and well-versed on that particular condition, maybe you should take that into account and say, hey, this could be something. Now, if I had presented with those symptoms and didn't have that medical pass, sure, that would be a perfect, you know, way to go about it. But it delayed the inevitable, which was really frustrating. And had we not known Dr. Markham, who knows how long it would have taken to get into a neurosurgeon. And I just found out, actually, funny thing, that neurosurgery neurology group in Tallahassee, I work with a guy whose wife works in that office. And so we've gotten to talk about that group and all. And he told me that my surgeon, Dr. Lawson, rarely sees patients in the office. And I was like, oh.
Anymore.
Well, but even when I was seeing him, that it was kind of a rarity that he was seeing patients in the office. And I was like, well, he did me a solid.
Thank you, Mary Jennifer.
Yes, thank you. It's just one of those things where even when you're advocating for yourself, people can make you think you're crazy. And I think back to, I hope I get her name right. Is it Yolanda? Nope. I feel so bad. It was so long ago that we interviewed. She runs the Vulvar Cancer Network. And I don't have my phone. I can't look it up, but I will put it on the screen right now of this lovely woman who it took.
Here's what I found.
Oh, nope. It took 7 years. She kept going back to the doctor saying, I have these symptoms. I've done my research. I think it's vulvar cancer. Please do a biopsy because that's the only way to diagnose vulvar cancer. And she was denied for 7 years. And then she had, I don't know, stage 3 or stage 4 vulvar cancer and had to go through all kinds of treatments and was still going through treatments when we were talking to her. And it's one of those things.
I think that's where this subject of gaslighting for an episode came up. We were talking about that.
Yeah. Yeah. And it just seems like, come on, people. A biopsy. That's an inpatient, right in the doctor's office, not a big deal procedure.
You know, I've thought about this a lot in our episodes, and it would be interesting to speak with a doctor, an ER doctor in particular, because that tends to be where a lot of the issues are with either they don't listen to you, they don't believe you, they, you know, like you said, they look for horses and not zebras. Just to get their perspective, maybe they would say, you don't know how many people come in every night and tell me they have this, 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 and this, yeah. and there's no way it could be that. And so I get that they could be biased.
That makes me think of my experience in Corpus Christi.
Oh my gosh.
Where I was in, I cannot describe to you, I was in the emergency room for maybe, I mean, like, from the time the ambulance doors opened to the time I walked out of the front door to get an Uber, maybe an hour. And they were doing the paperwork to admit me into the ER at the same time that someone walked in to release me from the ER. It was very dismissive. It was, here's a little bit of steroid, here's a shot, here's a prescription for muscle relaxers. We're not giving you any pain medication. We're not admitting you. We're not giving you a neurology or a neurosurgeon consult. No kind of consult. And, you know, that hospital, I don't know anything about that hospital except for my experience there. And it was very evident that that hospital sees a lot of transient people. It sees a lot of drug users. And so I don't know what they were thinking about me at the time. I'm from Florida, right? Like, they saw my license. I'm not from there. I don't know anybody there. So it was one of those things where it was just very dismissive. And, you know, she didn't try to make me feel crazy over and over and over again. But I did bring up, because I even, before I decided to go to the ER, I Googled, like, back injuries and when to go to the hospital and when to just ride it out and all of that. And it said, if you have any numbness or tingling, to go to the ER because it could be a bigger issue, a much bigger issue, and a permanent issue at that point. And my whole leg, both my legs were numb. And so I was like, well, I better go.
Yeah.
And, you know, and of course, you don't have, you know, a WebMD doctorate, but at the same time, if everything is saying, go to the ER, go to the ER, go to the ER, I'm going to do it.
Well, it like we said, they have had experiences that have colored the way they look at things,
right.
And there's probably a huge opioid crisis there, and they take it out on other people,
right.
And that somehow there needs to be some direction about that.
Yeah, well, and also it really is unfortunate for people who have high pain thresholds, because, I mean, Mom and I both do, and I'm not coming in screaming, crying in pain. I'm in a lot of pain, but I'm not passing out. Like it's one of those things where my 9 is probably somebody's 20, and, you know, and that's okay. Like, everybody has their own measure, but to, you know, look at me and be like, oh, you're not in that much pain. What do you want me to do? Writhe on the floor? Like, you know, I'm not going to be a stereotypical. I'm just going to deal with it the way I deal with it.
Yeah.
So everything really comes down to personal advocacy.
Right. I know, I don't remember if it was last episode or the one before that when we talked about my colonoscopy.
Yes.
And I just wanted to do a little follow-up.
Because, oh, yeah, you have an update.
Because it has to do with your own advocacy or advocating for yourself. I got a phone call to schedule this, you know, the doctor wanted to schedule, I had the colonoscopy on Tuesday, he wanted to schedule the repeat on Friday, and I was going out of town, couldn't do it. So he said his office would call me. Well, they called Monday or Tuesday, Monday, I think, and said they were going to schedule me for December. Now, I could have said, okay, and written down the thing, and I said,
and most people would have done just that.
Maybe so. I said, well, I'd like for you to check with the doctor about it. Because he wanted to do it Friday, but I'm going out of town, and actually it was before Friday, so it must have been like the next day. Anyway, because I hadn't gone out of town yet. I said, you know, he wanted to do it Friday, but I couldn't. So it told me he wanted to get me in there. He called this polyp precancerous. He said it was huge. So those two things make me think, let's, you know, get it out. And she said, well, I'll have to talk to his nurse, and I'll have to this, I'll have to that. I said, okay. So Tuesday, so that'd be a week later, his PA called me. She's the first and only person who apologized to me for what had gone on. And she said, I am really sorry. You should have gotten better instructions. You should have been told specifically what medication not to take. And she said, his nurse is going to call you and set up a time. But we've got to get clearance from your cardiologist. We've got to call the hospital because it has to be done at the hospital, not the outpatient. So I said, okay. Well, the next day, the nurse called, scheduled me. I'm scheduled for next week. But it just floored me that the first call I got, they said, we'll do it in December.
Yeah.
So, no, you got to advocate for yourself.
You do. You have to advocate for yourself. And there's no, you know, everybody is going by their book, right? They're playing by the rules. They're following procedures. And they're scheduling you when they have availability and all of that. And if they don't have all the information, which they probably didn't get or didn't listen to or whatever it might
or
be.
Or didn't read
some,
the file.
Right. There's some, you know, chink in the chain. And they just have to kindly remind them that, no, this is a different case. This is, you know, and it's the same thing. I have a friend who had, I talked about her before, she had major surgery to remove fibroids a couple months ago, I guess now. And there was a scheduling snafu and she was supposed to have it. And then she got bumped because he was out of town or something like that. And he put, and I, because I went to one of her appointments with her, he put on the scheduling thing, like, this is important, this is urgent kind of thing. And when they presented him with the schedule of, hey, we need to move some of these around because you're out of town or you have a C-section or whatever it was, and he said, well, bump that one. They didn't have the patient name. It was just the time slot and what the procedure was. And he said in that, he apologized and to her and said, if I had known it was you, I would not have bumped it. I would have figured something out. I would have come in or I would have bumped somebody else. And it, if you have all of the information, you can make a you know, more informed decision. So,
and I think that is the issue a lot of times.
Yeah, they just don't have all the information.
No, and the person who called me today to schedule for next week, she started the conversation by saying, boy, do I have a truckload of emails about you. I said, is that a good thing or a bad thing? She said, no, it means we're going to get you scheduled.
Yeah.
And, you know, so she read the emails.
Right. And that's all it takes is that extra little bit of time and extra little bit of effort.
Yeah. Back to circle around as we wrap it up about the Gaslight movie. Ingrid Bergman is the
main girl.
Paula. And Angela Lansbury is in it.
She's in it.
So it's, I think it's worth watching.
It is. It's free on Prime. So if you have Amazon Prime, it's free on there. The they actually have the British one and the American one. The American one is free, and then the British one you can rent. So maybe we'll watch the British one next. But
it's a typical 40s movie.
Yeah.
You know, it's black and white.
And it's interesting. It's a 40s movie set in the 1880s.
Oh, right.
Yeah, all of their attire and stuff.
Yes.
And so it's funny because I was thinking kind of in the beginning, because it's very much like that antebellum attire. Of course, it's London too. But I was just thinking, these people are from the 40s, but that's what they're wearing. And it's kind of like movies now about the 90s or the 80s, you know?
Yeah. But it was interesting to watch. And knowing that that's where the term came from, it's kind of neat to have that background.
And I kind of wonder, you know, how it came to be. Like, was it picked up by psychologists first and then went mainstream? I'm not really sure about the etymology and all, but that is where it came to be from. And, you know, I think it helps me understand a little bit about what that is and to recognize it in your life. Because I think...
So don't let any medical professionals gaslight.
Or anybody.
Well, anybody, but we're speaking specifically about health and medicine. But yeah.
Stick up for yourself.
It really was interesting to me to see how methodical he was about...
Well, and it was interesting because there are times where he was very... it was premeditated instances of making her think she was crazy. And then other times it was kind of on the fly. He took something that happened and turned it around. Very conniving, very narcissistic. Just, I mean, I thought it was very well done.
I did too.
The acting was really good. It would be interesting to see a modern take on it.
Yeah, I would love to see a modern take. I'm surprised there isn't one out there.
I know, especially how the terminology has really, you know, become mainstream as of late. So, yeah, well, go watch the movie. It's on Prime. And we will see you next week for an update. And how do I close the? How do I end an episode? I don't know. See you later. Bye.
Thanks for listening to this week's episode of Down There Aware. Be sure to like and subscribe on our new YouTube channel, as well as on your favorite podcast platform. You can find us at Down There Aware on all social media sites, Twitter, Pinterest, TikTok, Facebook, Instagram. If you have it, we're there at Down There Aware. You can learn more on our website, www.downthereaware.com, and always get in touch with us, downthereaware@gmail.com. See you next week.